Ribas is curator at the MIT List Visual Arts Center, and he was previously curator at the Drawing Center in New York. His most recent projects include exhibitions of the work of Stan van der Beek, Amalia Pica, Olivier Larik, and Akram Zaatari. Last March 2013, we met him in Milan at MiArt Fair, where he was invited to take part in The Ethics of Images, Contemporary Perspective on Reality, Representation and Realism, one of the talks curated by Fionn Maid together with Alessandro Rabuttini. Where the prime concern was the possibility for an ethical approach to images, both in terms of critical circulation and reproduction, João Ribas talked about new iconoclasm, and together we tried to address the issue of responsibility in relation to the new knowledge digital networks, wherein the authenticity of the images is decided by the viewer. Let's take Google as example. The more often an image is viewed, the more likely it gets the top of search results.
The iconoclasm idea that you're referring to was a link that I was trying to make between the classic, the historical iconoclasm, the moment in which, through the Reformation, there is a sort of attack on images, well-known historical moment in Europe in which there is a kind of a violence done towards images. And the image I showed was a relief from a cathedral in Utrecht where the faces had been chipped off. And it was not only reliefs and sculptures, but architecture itself was sort of the architecture of one certain strain of Christianity was sort of targeted by, in a sense, by another. I was trying to make a link between that moment and what may be a new violence on the image, which is twofold or two parts. One is the way, and this is something that also the artist Hito Steyerl has spoken about and has written about, in terms of a kind of bruising of images, a kind of violence done to images. One example is the way that an image is compressed and disfigured, pixelated by being exchanged. So you take an image and the sort of low-res idea of an image, how that may be a kind of iconoclastic gesture. Or on another level, the way that, for example, on sites like YouTube, films get cut into pieces, into chunks. And that itself is a kind of maybe a new iconoclastic gesture of taking a kind of whole image or whole, let's say, work and fracturing it into segments. Then there's, of course, the more, let's say, politicized or more open iconoclastic gesture, which was the way that certain images, we're not allowed to see certain images, or that certain images create or enact real physical violence on the world, whether it's through a perceived or maybe even accurate attack on particular religions that creates an outburst of violence, or whether it's this idea that for whatever reason there are things that cannot be represented or their representation is kept hidden. The second side is the way that, strangely enough, you could think about this fragmentation, the pieces, in a sense, of the sculptures that were destroyed in the sort of historical and iconoclastic moment, in a way, are being reconstituted, or their ontology is being reconstituted digitally. So if you think of the 3D mesh through which three-dimensional digital objects are constructed, that 3D mesh is, in a way, all the little pieces of broken images being structured again in a new kind of digital space, which is both sculptural, it's image, but it's also a thing. Steyerl talks about this as a kind of transitional space between 2D and 3D. So all of this together proposes a kind of a version of iconoclasm that I find really interesting, because it still speaks to, in a sense, the power of images and our own relationship to them and a kind of violence that we do to them, which we, in a sense, use the digital domain to do. And there's also a generosity involved, strangely, that it's by virtue of them being shared that they become kind of destroyed.
It is now evident how the YouTube kind of fragmentation is influencing the post-broadcast TV environment. What's happening in contemporary art? Is video making informed by such a fragmented aesthetics?
There's a kind of interesting exploration of this through a group of, it's called the New Aesthetic. So there's a sort of group of artists, designers, thinkers who are talking about this as a new aesthetic. So for example, the way that the pixel, the pixelation of an image or pixelized images, the pixel has sort of become a real object, that you find the pixel kind of being printed or having a material existence in the world. Or things like the way that devices see, the way that your phone sees, the way that a surveillance camera sees, or the way that the drone sees, is itself a new kind of fragmented image. It's a new kind of vision. And that starts to have an impact on not only media, but begins to have an impact on the physical world, because they become, in a sense, material. They're as real as they are images, at least in one school of thought. I think what's important to remember is that a lot of, to go back to your earlier, the Google question, which is related to this, the changes, I think, exist also on another level, which is that you were talking about the sort of quantification. And what's interesting is that there's a suggestion in this that this quantification implies a new relationship that we will have to images. Italian architecture historian Mario Carpo, who talks about this in relationship to the algorithm. So algorithmic thinking rather than craft-based thinking, or that the dream of mass customization leads to this condition of a new epistemology, which is based on searching rather than sorting. And David Joslett, the American art historian, talks about it as epistemology of search. And it's a Google logic, and the thing that interests me about it is what you're referring to, which is the relationships between a search and a return is one that's dominated by number or by algorithm. It's not dominated by logical patterns or necessarily affective patterns or the kind of epistemological patterns that we associate with taxonomy or homology or topologies. It's based on who controls the algorithm. But also creates an interesting position. And what I found is what the great impact on, say, contemporary art or visual culture today, I think, is based on that change. Not so much on the level or the surface of the image, but fundamentally about how things come together, how they're coexistent, simultaneous, or contiguous. So that when you plug something into a search engine, the return you get is based on an algorithm, and then you find yourself clicking through, and by the fifth or sixth or seventh click, you are so far away from the pattern that you, in a sense, established when you began. And that leads to all kinds of strange encounters, in a sense, between images or between information, but also is controlled to a certain extent by the deep focus now, in terms of economically deep focus, on search. So the kind of fantasy here is that you will be able to take your phone and plug in the name of your cousin, and that will trigger your cousin's Facebook page, where they are, how many children they have, what their favorite book is. You know, this idea that you can search through the entire world simultaneously and kind of reconsider or reformat, reorganize information exactly to your position in the world. That is so, I think that's fundamentally this change, and it's material, because I think you can see in how young artists work with sculpture, how they work with environment, how they work with images, that they are now thinking in these patterns rather than the more, let's say, enlightenment-based, the idea of, people used to talk about the internet as a kind of library or a kind of encyclopedia, and Wikipedia literally being this collective encyclopedia. And I think now the shift is that it's less an encyclopedia than it is a kind of searchable cloud. That, to me, I think is an interesting and very deeply resonant condition, and it creates this kind of iconoclasm that we were sort of suggesting, because in a sense everything needs to be reconstituted in this space.
Talking about images, it is significant the metaphor that stands for the engine, or better, for the entire environment we can meet our knowledge to, the cloud.
The irony is, of course, the cloud, right, is this airy, nebulous, miasmic sort of diaphanous thing, And the metaphor used to be the deeply traumatic, paranoid image, right? It was the mushroom cloud. It was the kind of the anxiety of the nuclear age. This was, in a sense, the image that represented the possible end of human civilization as we know it, was this cloud. And that has been turned into a totally different metaphor. It's a metaphor, the cloud is now where you want to put your whole life. It's where work gets done. So the dominant sort of traumatic disaster image, the horror image of the post-war era, has now become the utopian image of the future, where in a sense everything is already up there. But the metaphor itself is so misleading because in a sense it's an attempt to represent something which is so rooted in basic material conditions. It's rooted in space, in the sense that all these things need to be somewhere. So server farms, you know, large buildings that of high security, where these huge servers are that are controlled by, you know, pricing schemes. So you have like different layers of access, different layers of speed. You have, they're controlled by packets of air and energy. And the metaphor itself kind of masks this, all these relationships of power, you know, legal, political, ecological, and so forth. Google has just renamed their search division Knowledge Division, the Knowledge Division. They understand exactly these things. They understand that this is really a massive reorganization of knowledge in the 21st century.
What will be the future of images within this reorganizing environment? What's our responsibility to images and, above all, towards those images that exist only as images?
There's this very bizarre situation in which there's a kind of, again, it's a kind of partly ontological issue, but it's also, I think, part of an issue of what we were, at least I was talking about in terms of ethics. The ethics of a responsibility to or for images. Should we be then responsible for this image because, in a sense, it exists only as an image? And this also has to do with this idea that we are now relating to images through touching. We drag, flick, spread, you know, we use our fingers. Even these gestures are patented, you know, Apple owns them. Because in a sense, there's an expectation that you can touch every image. You know, it's a wonderful idea in the sense that reaching out to an image is sort of a fantastic concept. But at the same time, maybe it implies a certain kind of responsibility. And this is why I showed the Thomas Hirschhorn Touching Reality piece, which I think is just a great, great moment of showing the sort of deep importance of that gesture, particularly with images that you want to look away from. So to touch an image you want to look away from is sort of, because they're horrific, you know, is interesting. The relationship between that kind of gesture and the responsibility even for things that just exist as images, there's a kind of care that I think it implies. And the subtext here being that the origin of curating is care. The term itself refers to care. It refers to caring for or caring to, or in a sense caring about images. So I think that there's something there. I think, and I'm certainly not the first person to say this and won't be the last, I think the deeply significant aspect of the photographic image, which from its very beginnings it becomes associated with a register of death. So the photography, photographing the dead, was so such an important part of early photography. And in a sense, you could say this about every image, every photograph of anyone that's ever lived. You care for that photograph because it's a memory or a register of that person's life, of that person's existence, that then only exists as an image after they die. You know, so there's this, in a sense, images themselves begin to partake in this kind of life. And does this imply a certain kind of care?
We are now having evidences of two diverse impulses. The digitalization of processes and contents on one hand, and the archival impulse that is also about the fascination for material obsolescence. How are they interfering each other, and how are they interfering artistic practices dealing with archival material?
I think it's complicated. I think it has to do with the issue of a kind of historicity or a historical sense in the contemporary. That what I mean is that the time that the contemporary represents is as much about the past as it is about the future. This Derrida in Archive Fever talks about how the archive is not about the past, it's actually about the future. It's about what will have been the past that the archive is producing. And I think in a sense, contemporary art exhibitions also function as the archive of contemporary art, because they in a sense produce the archive from which contemporary art history will be written. In the sense that if you're writing about an artist, if you're art historically assessing an artist in, say, 20, 30, 40 years from now, you will inevitably have to talk about exhibitions. And so the exhibition archive, the curatorial archive, will become more and more important. So I think there's a lot of issues there. I think what's changing is accessibility, that more people can access the materials than the kind of earlier image of the scholar, you know, Benjamin and the archive kind of situation. So I think that's changing. I think the reason or the presence of the archive in contemporary art has many, many sources or origins. I think it has to do with the evidential, the importance of evidence in a certain kind of practice, the importance of documentarist or realist practices. I think there are a lot of different reasons. I don't know that the process of digitization itself, but I think maybe there is a relationship to it in the sense that if we are in a world of searching, maybe we're then more interested in the world of sorting. One of the wonderful things about the archive is that in many ways you cannot search it. It actually is just sorted, and you kind of discover something in there. And what I mean by search is that, you know, the idea of search is that you could put, you know, bananas, a microphone, and a pair of socks in the same place. You no longer have to put the socks on the sock file and the banana in the banana file. You can actually just search for it, you know. So, for example, my desktop on my computer, I have no folders. Everything's basically on the desktop because you don't need to do that anymore. I can search for the document. I don't have to order it. And of course, the archive is exactly the opposite. An archive, to be an archive in a sense, implies taxonomy and sorting and so forth. But I think it's at least a future version of the insanity. In the sense, the 20th century pathology or the 20th century insanity would be the impossibility of sorting, right? Because Benjamin talks about this in terms of unpacking his library. Or Perec actually also talks about it. You know, this sort of insane classification system, you know, the impossibility of this sort of Linnaean dream, in a sense, the Diderot's dream of the encyclopedia becomes the internet, sort of completed. That, I think, is the pathology. The sort of 20th century version of that pathology is hypersorting, you know, and cross-indexing, being able to organize all information into some kind of system, whereas maybe my insanity then is that having no system whatsoever and just retrieving it whenever I need it. There's a French historian, Pierre Nora, talks about the idea of the dignity of the memorable, what was remembered or what was kept. Nietzsche talks about this as sort of the untimely. What was kept was what was seen as having the dignity of the memorable. And Nora's contention is that now everything seems to have the dignity of the memorable. So the idea of the untimely, again, that which cannot be remembered or that which cannot be traced, you know, everything, this is recorded. So it's not even really a conversation for us. It's really a conversation for someone else. And it sort of implies that everything I've said has the kind of dignity of worthy of being remembered, which I don't think is the case. And I think that's a really interesting idea. It's sort of, instead of judging things based on a kind of legally compelled version of copyright or copyleft, to think about them in terms of ethically informed or ethically complicated. For example, what is that which has the dignity of the memorable, for example, in Nora's case? And in fact, memory is, as Nora suggests, is no longer actually memory. It's everything we've constructed to contain the anxiety of not knowing what is memorable. So we, in a sense, create these massive possibilities in which we can hedge, we can speculate in huge amounts. So we save every image because we don't know which one is important. Or we save every document because we don't know which one's important. You know, the cloud exists because the other cloud existed, meaning it was the threat of a nuclear disaster and the destruction of knowledge that a decentralized system was created to survive. So the cloud that we now, in a sense, live with or work in was created to solve the problem of the other cloud, which was the nuclear cloud. It was meant to survive, even in a sense, post human life, but of course is actually in fact subject to the most basic conditions of human labor, time, energy, territory. It's hard to know what is disappearing and what's appearing.
What is memorable then, and what happens when the dignity of the memorable crosses the rise of the individual self-reflection on social media? What we worry about the hyper-individuality of the social media, João Ribas reflects on the synchronicity kind of relations and events that social media can cause and allow.
You know, we may be transitional in the sense that, you know, maybe we're analogous to that first supposed audience that saw the Lumiere film, that, you know, when they saw the train coming towards them, they kind of ducked away. We may be just a version of that, that we don't know what to do with these tools yet. Or I just think that we're maybe in a sense, don't know what to do with the tools yet. I mean, we, socially speaking, in a large sense, what we always do with them, which is try to entertain ourselves, use them for our own vanity in some sense. We try to find a relationship to them that's both interesting but also completely self-absorbed, and perhaps their real use or their real benefit is yet unknown to us. I mean, in a very practical sense, that 50 years ago that we would have been talking about flying around in jetpacks and drinking out of toothpaste tubes, you know, that we would eat space food, and now our primary fantasies now, you know, the future isn't really what it used to be. The future isn't the future anymore. It struck me that if you look back at the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, the sort of typical sci-fi scenario was the last man on Earth. The guy wakes up one day, the world's gone through some kind of destruction, he's left by himself, he wanders around, he sometimes finds a woman there. She usually is mute, doesn't speak, she's sort of terrified and quiet, which is again, you know, this sort of, what a perverse, horrible fantasy, right? That in the future, there's only one woman and she doesn't speak. And they, in a sense, are responsible for recreating society. This is a very common motif in science fiction. And now the sort of sci-fi scenario is the end of the world after man. So it's about projecting ourselves, seeing beyond ourselves. So life after people. It's really about a post-human future. So the future itself isn't quite in our control, at least in the terms of an imaginary. We have sort of a limited set of imaginary futures. The whole point of this digression was to say, we may not even conceive of the kind of truly emancipatory, if you want to call it that, or socially positive relationships. But I think you can see interesting patterns developing of connections between parts of the world and new kinds of subjects that be created by those patterns. There is to use a metaphor that I quite like, there is a physicist named Wolfgang Pauli, who was a really important figure and posited the existence of the neutrino before it was experimentally verified, a huge figure. And there was a kind of joke running, sort of going about, which was this thing called the Pauli effect. And the idea was that whenever Pauli was in a laboratory or anywhere near a laboratory, the experiments would go crazy. So things would explode or machines would break or something horrible would always happen. So Pauli was, in a sense, this chaotic force. And there was a story in which there was a physicist who came back to the laboratory one morning and found that the cooling system in the laboratory had exploded. And he said, okay, let's find out, let's prove once and for all that the Pauli effect does not exist. So he sent Pauli a telegram and he said, you know, where were you last night? And it turns out that Pauli had been basically traveling on a train and had switched trains in that town that night. All these stories are made up, but or at least I would suspect. What's interesting is that actually Pauli's psychoanalyst was Jung, Carl Jung. And Jung became fascinated with this idea and called it synchronicity, right? Which is the two events that are not acausally related, but they sort of synchronous. But what is their relationship? He was trying to think about this, the synchronicity. What I'm interested in is this as a metaphor for these kinds of relationships that you're talking about, where something that exists in one place has a kind of parabolic arc. That's not even the right term, but you know, this situation in which events happen in places and they're related, but they don't sort of cause one another, but they're sort of linked. So I think the kinds of relationships that social networking platforms allow are precisely those. So you can think of the example of the Innocence of Muslims film, which, you know, was shown in Los Angeles to a very small audience, goes on YouTube, and then causes this, you know, this outbreak of violence. These two, this sort of strange connections between things. You can see this popping up where, as the art historian Claire Tankins pointed out, it's really interesting, as she pointed out in a lecture, that the Pussy Riot performance happened on the same day as Mardi Gras. This really, this sort of strange connection between these events. I think social media platforms allow that, allow sort of people to connect and to cause these reactions. So I think we just may not be able to know how to use them. I think we're still fumbling or trying. But I think you can already see how information is traveling and causing these kind of synchronous events that one cannot necessarily say, this happened because of this in any strict way, but is a kind of much looser, much more amorphous pattern.
Our conversation ends where it started, in the space between an image and its transmission.
Maybe we'll end with this. It's a great, we started with ethics, we'll end with ethics. It's a great Cortezar story, Julio Cortezar. Apocalypse at I can't remember the name of it. He travels to, I can't remember where he goes. It's so terrible. I don't remember the specifics. But basically, he goes and he sees a bunch of paintings done by sort of local artisans. I think it's Apocalypse at Salentinam or something. He goes, he sees these, and he takes pictures, he takes photographs of these sort of wonderful landscapes done by these local artists. He goes back, I think, he goes back to Paris, and he has the slides developed. And he's looking at the slides. And what's on the slides are pictures of basically of war crimes. That what he's seeing is a sort of horror of the kind of Latin American dictatorships, mass graves, executions, things like that. And then later his wife goes through the images again and she only sees these landscapes by these local artisans. So this idea that the memory of the image and the real image are so, can be so far apart. And in the space in between, I think, lies the true power of how images function. That's a wonderful story, and I think it says a lot about what we think an image contains and the fact that we need to not only pay attention to what's in an image, but what an image is, which are two different things.
The title of the book is Apocalypsis de Solentiname by Julio Cortezar. Interview was produced by RadioPapesse.org.